Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Cryptocurrency is a digital currency that works through a computer network independent of any central authority such as government or bank. It's booming with a total market value of roughly $1.7 trillion. And regulators are taking notice. The Securities and Exchange Commission last week beefed up its crypto enforcement team to better police fraud. But strategies for regulating the fast-growing crypto industry on a larger scale still are in development. Washington Post reporter Tori Neumeyer covers economic policy, including crypto regulation. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So can you give us an overview of how cryptocurrencies and other digital assets, such as they're known, have been regulated so far? Is there anything?
You know, at the federal level, there really hasn't been an overarching comprehensive strategy for even classifying digital assets, much less regulating them. So there's an active debate among financial regulators about whether these things behave more like securities, traditional stocks, for example, or more like commodities like gold. And the answer to that question is really important because it begins to direct which regulator, in this case, the SEC versus the CFTC, should take the lead in developing rules. But until those very basic questions are answered, these regulators are having a difficult time figuring out how they're supposed to share responsibility here. And there really isn't the beginnings of an answer yet, and the a framework for governing these things.
Is there a global role here, or does it have to be country by country, or EU by country, or whatever?
There certainly can be a global role that hasn't been something that's emerged yet, and it's something that the industry is sort of leaning on, which is to say there is a patchwork of regulations. And to the extent that the U.S. has been more enforcement heavy, so in the absence of a regulatory framework, the SEC has been pretty aggressive in saying, going after crypto projects that they think run afoul of decades-old securities laws, and then bringing enforcement actions against them. In most cases, these things settle out of court with the companies paying hefty fines. And the industry says, that doesn't make any sense for us. And if you keep sort of bullying us this way, there are many more friendly jurisdictions abroad where we are going to set up shop, and it's going to be a competitive disadvantage to the United States in the long term, because this growth industry that could define the next, generation of finance and beyond is going to end up setting up shop everywhere else besides the United States. That is not convinced regulators who are skeptical of the value proposition here from altering their approach so far. But that's one of the legs of this debate.
Skeptical of the value proposition. What do you mean by that?
Well, Gary Gensler is the chairman of the SEC and has been very aggressive in policing this space, says, look, there is a possibility here that there will be economic use cases for cryptocurrencies as payment alternatives to the dollar that move faster and are cheaper for people. There are all sorts of gaming applications and others that you could imagine. None of that has been realized yet. And I think even most people in the industry quietly would acknowledge that has yet to come. In the meantime, a lot of these tokens have become very hot speculative bets. And so it becomes a kind of wild west, as Gary Gensler says, for speculators, and investors are left unprotected. And so that is the view of this space that he takes. The industry says, well, if you choke off development of this ecosystem before it really gets its feet under it, we're never going to see those use cases kind of mature and develop and ultimately manifest. But we're in this kind of weird liminal space between what it has been, which is the speculative free for all, and what it might be, which is the sort of the future of finance and the future of tech and all of these kind of high flying promises that believers in the technology will tell you about.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about cryptocurrency, the growth, and the proposition, or the you know, what regulation might look like. My guest is Tory Newmyer. He is a national reporter for The Washington Post. He is focused on economic policy and including cryptocurrency. Can it be both? Can it be both a speculative, you know, wild, wild west and part of the future of finance as we know it?
It could be. I think maybe that's what we're seeing right now. And you could argue that with the advent of any new technology, and Gary Gensler would, I think, say this himself. He taught a class at MIT on blockchain technology and crypto before he was confirmed as the SEC chair. And this is one of the points he made in the class, which, you, if you're interested and you want to deep dive into this, you can watch it all for free on YouTube. But he has said, you know, with every new generation of financial product or innovation, there tends to be a period of at least a decade when it is sort of figuring itself out. And regulators haven't quite decided what it is, if it needs their attention in the first place. And then once they decide it's reached a sort of critical mass, how do they classify it and then fit it into a financial regulatory structure that has been kind of building on itself for, you know, the better part of the last century. And it may well be that that's where we are in crypto right now, is that space where it's sort of figuring itself out. Regulators don't quite understand it yet. But I think if you're more in mind of the kind of investor protection risk here, there is some urgency as we see the markets growing geometrically here. I mean, this was not, these were not really on the radar just a few years ago because the digital markets were a fraction of the size of what they are now. And as this grows and it draws in more retail interest, mom and pop investors, people who are starting to put meaningful slices of their retirements into this because they think it's only going up, up, up. The urgency, I think, is compounded for regulators to try to get their arms around it, make sure that the disclosures are there, and it fits into a framework that allows investors to be protected. And there's no better example of the need for that than what we're seeing, just what we've seen in the last sort of 24 hours, where there's been this huge sell-off in cryptos that is following a sell-off in tech stocks. Mm-hmm. Cryptos really behave, investors treat them like tech stocks right now, meaning they see them as very risky assets. And then in a moment when investors broadly start to get nervous about the direction of the economy, they start selling tech stocks, you know, they start selling cryptos along with them. They're kind of handcuffed together. And it's dangerous if you've got, you know, if you're overexposed there.
When you talk about protections for investors, are you thinking, is that like something like the FDIC with my deposit in the bank kind of thing?
Well, it depends on how we're classifying these assets. Okay. But if you think of them as a stock, any company that's offering a security has to come in sort of the front door at the SEC. They say, here's who we are. This is our management. They offer a series of disclosures. They talk about risks that might cloud their financial, you know, their outlook, things that could affect them to the downside, and they explain how they plan on making money. And so investors presumably can go read all of that stuff at the SEC. These are public disclosures, and they're rather extensive, and they can make a decision. And that is that transparency is at the heart of the SEC investor protection regime, which is let investors know, and then they can make decisions based on the information that they gather, but at least they're not betting kind of in the dark on these things. And that is something that distinguishes crypto from, you know, buying a stock in Ford or Apple right now. You don't have any transparency into, you don't have a view into who's really behind these things? Are they conflicted? Are there, you know, and are they really who they say they are?
You know, I don't watch a lot of commercial TV, but I did watch the Super Bowl this year. And There was, I think, notably Matt Damon, you know, the big super movie star, pushing cryptocurrency. And it kind of surprised me. They've got sort of these, I'm just wondering about the strategy of that and really who is the potential cryptocurrency investor at this point, somebody who can handle a lot of risk. But then you talk about people dumping sizable portions of their retirement savings into them. So I'm trying to get a fix on who is it out there that's driving this and has helped the industry grow so much in recent years?
Well, certainly those ads were targeting retail investors who are going to, who they would like. I mean, these were crypto trading platforms. So those were ads from crypto.com and FTX, which are both, you can kind of think of them as Robinhood for crypto. Hmm. So you get, you know, you link your bank account to an account with one of these services, and they allow you to buy, sell, trade, hold in crypto. And so those services are really focused on retail investors. We're not talking about, as they say in crypto, whales. We're not talking about institutional investors. We're talking about, you know, real mom and pop type people. And so because that's the customer, that's who those trading platforms are trying to reach. And increasingly, as this is, I think, gotten more sort of pop culture penetration, and everybody now, it seems, is one degree of separation from someone who is at least invested, if not working on some project or protocol or some new crypto thing. It's just sort of surrounding people. And so I think there's a, you know, the internet term of art for this is FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. Mm-hmm. That as this thing seems to be on a rocket ship ride up, people are making fortunes out of nothing. There's a fear of missing out, and people want to be, you know, understandably, people want to get in on that. But of course, you know, the laws of financial physics still apply here. What goes up can come down, especially when you're talking about something that isn't undergirded by any kind of fundamental value. There's nothing being produced here. So it's worth sort of what the sentiment in the market says it's worth. And that can inflate very easily, but it can also deflate very easily. And that's what we're seeing this week.
Some in the industry would prefer to see regulatory authority in the hands of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. You mentioned that earlier. What's the ups and the downs on that score?
At a certain point, it comes down to the personalities involved. I mean, mm-hmm. there was some excitement with Gary Gensler when he was coming in, because the industry knew that he cared enough to learn about blockchain and teach a course on it at MIT. They thought, well, you know, clearly he must believe there's something here. It turns out once he got into office, he has behaved much more critically. He presents himself in the lectures, if you go watch, as someone who's sort of center bearish. He's kind of neutral leaning skeptical. He's behaved much more skeptically as a regulator. And they have discovered that. The industry has discovered that over the course of the last year and been, you know, bitterly disappointed by it. And in Rostam Benham, who is the new chair of the CFTC, they have someone who's much more bullish on the technology, and they think he's a guy who wants to craft regulations that are going to be friendlier to the industry.
You've written about the potential creation of a so-called digital dollar. Can you compare and contrast that?
So this is a kind of a, this is something called, it's called a central bank digital currency. And this is something that would be issued by the Federal Reserve. It would be worth a dollar, but it would transact digitally, and it would allow people to make payments presumably much faster. So if you're, you know, waiting for a check to deposit, sometimes that can take a couple of days before you actually see the money, you know, between payday and when you actually see the money hit your bank account. If you're making payments across international borders, there are fees associated with that. So this is a potential way to eliminate all that and allow people to transact in real time. And the upside would be for people who are unbanked or underbanked, have less, poorer people who have less access to the financial system. But it brings with it a whole bunch of privacy concerns and potential implications for monetary policy. So the Fed is exploring this, but it is really at the beginning stages of this, and they are sort of asking very philosophical questions at this point about whether it's worth the trouble, essentially.
You know, the way you put that, they're asking very philosophical questions. I'm wondering, is the mechanism, that manages the financial world in the U.S. at least, is it prepared to take this on anyway?
Is the United States prepared?
Yeah, there's just the regulatory, you know, the SEC or whatever it might be. Is it actually prepared to take on regulation should they embark on anything like that when it comes to cryptocurrency?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, all of these guys feel like they've been starved for resources for too long. So last week we saw the SEC announced that they are doubling the size of their crypto enforcement team. Which sounds like a big deal, and I suppose it is, but it means they're going basically from 30 people to 20 people, to 50 people. They're adding 20 people. And I guess 20 smart people, you know, who are directed in a certain way can do a lot of, can accomplish a lot, but we're not talking about, you know, this isn't a massive pivot by the federal government, reallocation of resources to tackle this stuff. So, you know, I think, it's a fair question, and I'm sure the agencies would say they could always use more help.
Tory Newmyer, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Tory Newmyer is a national reporter for the Washington Post, focused on economic policy, and we've been talking about cryptocurrency and potential for regulation in the future. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Child welfare agencies across the country are using algorithms to help social workers decide which families should be investigated for neglect first. New research from Carnegie Mellon University finds that the algorithm used by Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, an early adopter of the technology, disproportionately flagged Black families for mandatory review. And that's causing some to rethink the use of this technology. Associated Press investigative correspondent Sally Ho covers child welfare systems and foster care in the U.S. with a focus on the data behind it. Her April 29th article about the algorithm issue is part of an ongoing series that investigates the power and consequences of decisions driven by algorithms on people's everyday lives. We'll post a link to that at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome, Sally Ho.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So how did the researchers from Carnegie Mellon figure out that from August 2016 to May 2018, the algorithm flagged a disproportionate number of Black children for mandatory or Black families for mandatory investigation?
Carnegie Mellon has been studying, sort of has had ongoing studies with Allegheny County. And so they received data from the county itself and was advised by the county on how to analyze the data. And the study showed that the algorithm's pattern of flagging a disproportionate number of Black children for a mandatory neglect investigation. And that means the algorithm was advising social workers. The algorithm that was advising social workers was more likely to determine a Black family to be at the highest risk for neglect 32% of Black children got mandatory investigation labels compared to 20% of white children, according to the research. And that issue of disparity in child protective services really has consequences on both ends. On the one hand, you could be investigating too many meritless allegations involving Black children, and the investigations are known to be very intrusive, and that can, you know, the process of investigation can destabilize a vulnerable family on its own. But on the other hand, if the algorithm is somehow underestimating the risk of white children, then of course there could be consequences there too. And our reporting did reveal that for more than 2.5 years, there was a technical glitch in the tool that sometimes presented social workers with the wrong scores, either underestimating or overestimating a child's risk. And the county has said they've since fixed that glitch.
So what was the glitch? I mean, if they fixed it, then no problem?
Yeah, the glitch was that it wasn't populating all of the information because the way that this tool works is that the tool predicts the risk that a child will be placed in foster care in the 2 years after they are investigated. And so the algorithm is a statistical calculation based on detailed personal data collected from birth, Medicaid, substance abuse, mental health, jail, probation, those kind of records, among other government data sets. The algorithm then spits out a score between 1 to 20 that is presented to the social workers who are deciding if a family should be investigated in the first place. And the greater the number, the greater the risk. With that number, there were times that social workers didn't see the right number, the actual number that the algorithm actually calculated.
The rationale for using an algorithm was that it would take some of the human bias out of the process by adding these statistical calculations to the social workers' decisions. But the algorithms, I mean, besides this glitch, the algorithms can have bias baked in, right? Or was that the glitch that the bias was baked in?
The glitch is separate from this concern. And I would say it's one of the primary concerns about using predictive analytics in child welfare is the fact that child welfare systems historically have had a disproportionately punishing effect on families of color and Black families in particular. And the data on that trend is firm, that Black children are more likely to end up in foster care and least likely to ever get reunified with their families. And so a prevailing concern for using data algorithms in child welfare work is that this could actually lead to garbage in, garbage out, or the idea that a flawed data premise will lead to a flawed data calculation. And if you think about this broadly in the field of child welfare, it's well established that human bias is a problem. So does the algorithm mitigate that human bias, or could algorithms actually harden or have the potential to worsen existing racial disparities? Because now social workers who may have been on the fence or otherwise swayed by this tool can then have the confidence of science. And so that is a prevailing concern it's the prevailing concern and critique of even the concept of using this in child welfare.
That it can actually double down the bias, not alleviate it.
Right. That is a major concern.
What about the social workers who work with this algorithm? What do we know about what their satisfaction rate was with that? How did it work for them?
Well, Carnegie Mellon found that the majority of the social workers they engaged with in their qualitative work actually disagreed with the tool sort of philosophically, but they only actually disagreed with the tool in practice about a third of the time. And so part of the ongoing debate is sort of looking at how influential is this tool on the work of the social workers. Because as they're making these decisions, you know, the county is very clear that the social workers can override the score, even if it gives you a mandatory investigation label or a high risk protocol determination. And the point being, like, you know, that this is supposed to somehow make up for racial disparities, but we see sort of the opposite sometimes in this data, which is that the scores themselves are more desperate. The scores themselves are more desperate than the actual decisions that the social workers make. And so that leads to this kind of really interesting philosophical question about the tool's usefulness, because the county's saying social workers are always in control, that the human social worker ultimately owns that decision of whether or not a family is investigated. But if there's sort of a line of defense to combat the racial disparities that show up in the tool, then the question becomes, how does the tool improve the work of child welfare when the tool has more disparate recommendations?
You know, I'm wondering about the social workers. You said they can override it, but ultimately they own their own decision. So what if they make the wrong decision and the algorithm made the right decision? Hypothetically, is that then can that be used as a cudgel against them? Can that be used as, would they be wary of not going with the algorithm? Because the algorithm in a way protects them, but if they go independent, go rogue, and just make their own decision, they don't have the protection of the algorithm, or they can't blame anything.
Yeah, you know, the county would not consider that going rogue. The county thinks that this is, you know, just one part of the process, and is seen as an advisory tool. But you know, it's really hard to study scientifically what that looks like, right? All we can see is that the tool gave these kind of scores and the social workers made these kind of decisions. And it should be noted, you know, this decision-making process has always been an issue in the work of child welfare, because, you know, social workers are you know, sort of tasked with this really important decision of like, do we investigate them? Do we not investigate them? And, you know, in some ways, this is a really impossible task with or without the algorithm, mm-hmm. because they are having to make really quick decisions about really potentially very consequential outcomes. So, you know, the process is troubled. And I think that's part of why data algorithms has been embraced in some circles, because, you know, this is a field that is desperate for change and has been for a long time. So I think this is part of the evolution. And the county would say, you know, this is the way we do it. You know, this is our decision making. Some other counties may use like a pen and paper kind of rubric. So it's not a perfect process whether or not you use the algorithm.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Sally Ho. She is an Associated Press investigative correspondent. She covers child welfare systems and foster care in the U.S. with a focus on the data behind it. And the article that we're talking about, her recent article, is about the use of algorithms to screen child neglect cases. It's part of an ongoing series. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. What about other states? I mean, this, you know, we've been talking about this case in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. But is this spreading? Is it in wide use?
I wouldn't say it's in wide use, but it has been explored in a number of states. It's the American Civil Liberties Union has tracked the use of these algorithms in child welfare systems in at least 26 states plus Washington, D.C., including in Ohio's Franklin and Hamilton counties. Mm-hmm. And in those counties in Ohio, you know, they piloted the Eckerd Rapid Safety Feedback Model, which is different than the one in Allegheny County, but they piloted that in 2018 and eventually dropped it due to what the ACLU found was, quote, significant limitations. And so you do see that. We've seen a number of states and county jurisdictions that have tried it, thought about it, you know, and gotten to various levels of deployment. It's only been deployed in 11 states, meaning by 11 jurisdictions. So there's been not widespread use, but there is, it's really a concept that has captured the attention of lots and lots of social worker agencies.
Is it, I mean, I guess it would say it's to be more accurate and more, but is it also an efficiency, a human resource issue?
I think the developers have always talked about this in a way that, you know, if you do a better job at screening who gets investigated, then you become more thorough and more efficient. You are more thorough and not missing the children who, you know, CPS, Child Protective Services, is often in the news in a really negative, high profile way when a child dies, that, mm-hmm. that you know, per, perhaps that they should have intervened or something like that. That's always usually the narrative. So there is a lot of concern about, you know, are we thorough enough? Are we catching everyone we should be investigating? Are we intervening in the families that really need us? And on the flip side, you know, it's sort of, it's not in dispute that the system captures a great number of families that aren't actually at risk for harm and may just be suffering from poverty. Because, you know, when you look at neglect, and the vast majority of children reported to Child Protective Services is for neglect, it can be anything from poor hygiene, inadequate housing, even truancy. And these are things that, you know, really depending on who you ask, may or may not be actually dangerous in the lives of children. And so that is part of the ongoing work of how do we do this better? You know, how do we make sure we're more thorough and more efficient?
What about the issue of transparency? Most Child Protective Services won't tell their families their risk score from these algorithms. Why is that?
So Allegheny, for one, is among the child welfare agencies who have decided not to share the risk score with the family. And the county has said that, the county's director has said she's personally opposed to it because she fears it will make vulnerable people broadly hesitant about any public or community services because they may fear such data could be used against them when determining, you know, if their child is reported for neglect. On the other hand, you know, there's really a due process question here, mm-hmm. which is why we profiled a family law attorney who's really asked this question of due process and probable cause, essentially. If it leads them to be investigated, should they know why they got a mandatory score or if they did? And, you know, on that end of, you know, favoring transparency is an agency in Colorado which has told us, you know, they're piloting a similar algorithm tool, and they've actually said, we think it's unethical not to share with families how the scores affected their case. And that if they proceed with it, this tool, that they plan to share it to minimize the power differential between social workers and families.
How would that, you said they plan to share it? Oh, I see. They plan to share the score. So, right. Okay. And how does that work then? I mean, you get your score and then you can at least try to defend yourself and say, well, that's wrong and that kind of a thing, or?
I think, you know, in the process of working with child welfare, I mean, they're supposed to be a service to the family, right? So I'm not exactly sure how they plan to do it. We haven't heard from anybody who is actively doing that. For example, a different county in Colorado said they would offer the score if the family asked. So, and this is a problem that we heard from the family law attorney that we profiled in our story, who has, you know, she's just really concerned about the secrecy, and, you know, that she never really knows how these cases came to be and if the algorithm had a hand in it. And so part of the concern about transparency is that should it just be, you know, open to the public? Should people know about it? Some people are really concerned about offering what is a really complicated a really complicated system to explain to the masses that in a way that would be really understandable. The county, for example, has said, you know, this is a really sophisticated kind of process, and how do you explain it? You know, how do you even execute that? Just like your question, how do you execute that? Do you tell all families who are reported? Half of all families who get reported to CPS, they get run through the system, but they never get investigated. Does it do more harm than good? I think that's a central question in this, in the execution and the deployment of the model.
Well, I guess bottom line, though, is who gets access to the information? If the people that are the subject of it don't get access to it, then how is it limited otherwise? And then, of course, you know, there's all kinds of things as far as fraud and abuse.
In Allegheny County, it's only seen by the hotline worker. So a call comes in, the hotline worker, you know, inputs the information, does an assessment, sees the score, makes a determination. And then it's not passed on. The county says it is not passed on to the actual caseworker in the field who actually goes and engages with the family, investigates them in person, and, you know, can make the decision of foster care removal, for example, and can make the determination of, you know, whether the allegations are founded. And so the county says, you know, the reason why they don't share the score with anybody is because they don't want it to influence what happens in the investigation, what happens in the courtroom. And that it's because the county says that this is really part of just the screening process and is just a tool that advises the social workers.
Well, Sally Ho, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Associated Press investigative correspondent Sally Ho, she covers child welfare systems and foster care in the U.S. with a focus on the data behind it. And her recent article about the use of algorithms to screen child neglect cases is part of an ongoing series investigating the power and consequences of decisions driven by algorithms on people's everyday lives. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Apple's self-service repair program launched last week in a concession to the right to repair movement. But repairing your phone yourself won't be easy, and it may not be cheaper. I can't even imagine doing it. Here to tell us about it is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
I just want to I can't imagine repairing my own phone. Have they kind of brainwashed me?
No, it's not for everyone. You know, not everyone has the kind of technical knowledge. And it is to Apple's great credit that in a vast majority of situations, if you have broken whatever your Apple gadget is, you can walk it into an Apple store and say, please fix this thing. And they actually fix it instead of giving you a new one. Because, you know, that's you know, a net positive when it comes to this sort of thing. But mm-hmm. if you are someone like me, who has three kids who have broken just about every piece of electronics that they could possibly get their hands on at one point or another in their childhood, because I, as a father who loves gadgets, kept giving them screens to break. Being able to repair them myself is valuable. And to be clear, what we're talking about here is the ability to repair something without having it void the warranty. So, you know, I have broken tablets and phones and things, and I've just replaced the screen myself because there wasn't a very good warranty on it. But when it comes to Apple parts, the warranties are quite good. And so by replacing the screen myself through parts that I've gotten, especially if I'm using official parts, it shouldn't void my warranty. And that's something that Apple has finally started to acquiesce to. But it is worth pointing out that the process that Apple goes through, that Apple asks you to go through in order to ensure that you are still maintaining that warranty is almost not worth it.
And it doesn't apply to all of their gadgets, right?
Correct. Right now it applies to a handful of the most recent phones, and that's pretty much it. You know, it hasn't expanded yet to tablets or laptops or anything like that. And a lot of that has to do with what we know from, there are several, you know, websites who, when a new product comes out, a new popular product comes out, they take it apart to you know, kind of rate its repairability rating. And we know that a lot of Apple products are held together quite literally by adhesive. There's just a ton of glue inside of these things, and that makes it very difficult to repair without having, you know, kind of the adhesive to repair it yourself. Phones are a little easier in that situation, because there's a lot less of that adhesive in there, but it's still, you know, it's still a challenge to go in there. The real issue here is that, you know, Apple has, made it so that you can go to this special website that they've created for self-service repair and order the parts that you need directly from Apple in order to maintain that warranty. They also offer tool rentals if you don't have the tools necessary to replace it, because Apple often uses custom bits for things. For example, it has its own proprietary screw for its iPhone on in several parts. You can only it's actually quite difficult to get the screwdriver bit to use inside of this thing, depending on where you are and kind of where you're looking. So we've done a little bit of math, and if you buy the parts to repair your screen for an iPhone SE, and you have to rent the tools, it costs about $191 to do all of that. If you walk into an Apple store and ask them to repair it, it only costs $141, which is frustrating to say the least.
Well, all right. So you said at the beginning to Apple's credit, but it sounds like it's a little disingenuous.
So the right to repair
of propriety.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you're seeing here, I guess what I'm saying when I say to Apple's credit is that, you know, it is relatively easy to get Apple to repair something for you.
Oh,
and
yeah,
as we've seen, it's a, you know, it's fairly economical compared to what they have offered. But yeah, it can be challenging to accept this as kind of as progress, when it's such a limited policy, and in many cases it can end up actually being more expensive. That having been said, if you have made this repair to your display, or you know, kind of replaced a speaker or something like that, or replaced a battery in phones that have aging batteries, those phones can end up lasting significantly longer than they would otherwise.
And you won't be violating the warranty.
Correct.
First and foremost, so that you could bring it back later.
Yeah. So if something catastrophic does happen,
yeah,
you know, then it can still be repaired beyond what you feel like you're comfortable doing.
Manufacturers, it sounds like they can make them easier to repair, right?
They could make it considerably easier to repair. And in fact, there have been a lot of research that has shown that phones have, especially phones, have gotten increasingly more difficult to repair over the last 5 years by someone at home.
What's the most typical repair? Is it changing the screen? Or
the screen is almost always the most common thing. The battery is the second. You know, phones have roughly about a 2-year shelf life as far as your battery goes. So if you're planning on keeping your phone for, you know, 3 or more years, that battery is probably going to start really taking a hit and only lasting about, you know, half of its expected life by about the 2.5 year mark.
What about, is there a market for, or is there for repair? You know, I remember I was thinking about paying somebody off market to repair a screen or replace a screen or something, but it turned out it was just as cheap to just go into Apple and do it. But anyways, is there much of a market out there for repair businesses out there that would?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially in places where there's not an Apple store in close proximity.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pretty fortunate to live in an area where there are two that are relatively close by, but that's definitely not the experience for a lot of people. So, you know, by having that kind of mall kiosk that has Apple certified repair people in it, or you know, Google certified repair people in it, mm-hmm. for folks who have Pixel phones, then that can end up being just as good.
Okay. You wanted to talk about the AnyCubic Cobra, the 3D printer. Oh, that's right. We talked about that last week.
Briefly brought this up last week. Yeah. So I've been playing with this 3D printer for a little while, and it is the first. So when it comes to 3D printers, you have very, very expensive 3D printers that are actually quite easy to use and have a great deal of features in them. And you have inexpensive 3D printers that are actually quite difficult to use because they don't have any of those additional features. And so getting a quality kind of consistent print out of those inexpensive printers can actually be a lot of work. And when you go into a library that has 3D printers, or a school that supports 3D printers, or you know, kind of a local hobby shop or something, it's almost always those inexpensive models for obvious reasons. When you're buying five of something, you know, spending $1,000 on each one of them is just not an option. I really, really like the AnyCubic Cobra because it's a $300 printer that has a lot of the kind of ease of use functions that a higher quality printer will have. The place where the print goes on the bottom, the heat bed, does what is called auto leveling and heating, which means it, you know, every single time you start the printer up, the part that actually does the 3D printing checks to make sure that the base is where it's supposed to be, so that you're not accidentally, you know, kind of squirting plastic out and not making something. And the software in it can be pretty useful when it comes to, you know, making sure that the printer is actually doing what it's supposed to.
You're going to have to fiddle, though, no matter what, right?
Yeah, I mean, any 3D printer has a fair bit of setup and kind of trial and error to make sure that you get it work initially. You know, that's just kind of the out-of-box experience for most 3D printers. What sets this apart is that I set this up and 2 months later have not had to make any adjustments in order for it to be consistently good at what it does, which is not the experience for most 3D printers in this price range.
What are you making?
Oh, well, okay. I know my the audience here already thinks I'm a big nerd, so I guess I'm not really giving much away. I made a great big lightsaber for a thing that I'm doing. I've made a couple of things for friends who have asked. You remember the movie The Mummy?
Yes, with Brendan Fraser.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know how I remember that. Okay, go on.
There's like the book, the special book that has all the magic stuff in it, and then the weird key that opens the book. I printed the weird key that turns and it like pops open and does stuff for a close friend of mine. There's a lot of little things like that, but I've also found 3D printing to be quite practical when it comes to replacing certain things in the house. For example, my shades here in front of my window broke last week because I pulled too hard on them, and I could actually just take the individual pieces and piece them together and take a picture of it and then print a replica of it instead of going to Target and getting it.
Wow.
Which some might laugh at and say, you spent 3 hours recreating this thing that you could have gotten at Target for $1.50. And you're right, but I didn't have to drive to Target. So as far as I'm concerned, I won.
The software, though, you'd like to see some improvements?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're making something that is kind of out of the box, something for everyone, the thing that is on the printer is pretty good. The thing that's on the computer where you're actually getting the file and telling it what to do in order to make the printer is still still pretty challenging. And if the goal is to make this something that is kid friendly in libraries or something that is great for people who have never touched 3D printers before, the kind of software that's on the computer, needs to be something that everyone can sit down and actually understand what's going on.
My producer, Bobby, needs a new TV remote battery cover.
I can do that.
Okay. Google's developer conference is later this week, and you think they're going to unveil a new smartwatch. Why?
So it's something that Google has been talking about for quite a while now. There have been a lot of partnerships in an attempt to kind of change its future in the smartwatch market. Google has tried on multiple occasions now to make smartwatches that compete with the Apple Watch, and each one of them has unfortunately failed in very different ways. What is very different this time is that Google now owns Fitbit and has had Fitbit as a part of its company for some time now, and has successfully released new Fitbit watches under this branding, kind of partnership. So all of that kind of know-how for making a good watch and having that kind of quality battery life and making sure that it actually, does all the things that it's supposed to is now a part of that Google architecture. And people who own Fitbits really like them. So if Google's able to kind of extract some of that that know-how and put it into a more advanced watch, it could end up being a fairly big deal.
Yeah. All right. So an actual competitor to the Apple Watch, then.
Right. And that's kind of the goal here is to have something for not quite the Fitbit audience, but someone who is an Android user who wants a watch that is on the same level as an Apple Watch.
And finally, I mean, developer conferences, we've talked about them before, but just could you give us a little thumbnail of what those are? It's for people who like to monkey with all this stuff and come
Absolutely.
Up with apps, right?
Yeah, Google will take this opportunity. They'll spend, the event starts tomorrow, and they'll spend all of Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday kind of breaking down all of the new things that are coming to all of its platforms and how developers can use that to build new stuff. So the next version of Android that'll come out later this year, the next thing that they're going to do inside of your car when you plug your phone into your car, like all of those technologies will have software updates that are coming later this year, and Google will take a minute to announce those things and then show how developers can kind of build that into the things that they already have.
Do you go to things like that?
I have been to several Google IOs. This year is a combination of hybrid and not, and so I'm just going to cover it from Maryland.
Russell Holley, thanks as always for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's managing editor for commerce at CNET. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.